Welcome to the CSIS Kajet Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. In Hong Kong, more than 1,000 students and faculty members marched through one of the city's leading universities in silent protest against what they describe as an intensifying assault on academic freedoms driven by Beijing. The march comes after the University of Hong Kong's Governing Council voted down Johannes Chan, known as a liberal law professor, for a position as pro-vice chancellor. In Tokyo, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe expressed hope after a meeting with Russia's Deputy Prime Minister for progress in bilateral talks on concluding a post-World War II peace treaty. The Soviet Union and Japan never concluded a comprehensive accord after the war. As a result, disputes over four Russian-held isles off Japanese-owned Hokkaido continued to the present day. In Seoul, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported that North Korea stepped up activity at its main nuclear facility in Yongbyon. An agency spokesperson said that evidence was visible through satellite imagery of work on a 5-megawatt reactor located at the complex, including the arrival of new equipment and changing water levels. In Atlanta, the 12 trade ministers of the Trans-Pacific Partnership countries announced this week that they overcame the last obstacles and reached a final agreement. TPP, as it's more commonly known, will still need to be signed and approved by each of the parties to the deal. And picking up on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I sat down with Scott Miller, our Scholl Chair in International Business, and Matt Goodman, our Simon Chair in Political Economy, to pick their brains on the path ahead for the TPP and what it means.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade agreement bringing together 12 Asia-Pacific economies who have been working for the last 5.5 years to negotiate a comprehensive, high-standard, so-called 21st century trade and investment agreement that has two broad components. One is enhanced market access, giving more market opportunities for exporters around this region, lower tariffs and other restrictions on access to markets, and then establishment of new and updated rules for international commerce, rules that are called 21st century because they get to issues not just at the border where there are customs problems and tariffs and so forth, but get behind the border to the issues that really affect global supply chains, which are really the basis of international commerce today. So it gets at things like regulatory standards, at competition policy, at intellectual property protection, at treatment of services, of a range of other issues that that trade agreements to date have not either handled at all or at least only lightly covered. So it's a new and big and really historic new milestone in trade policy.
And has anything like this ever been done before? I mean, you hear about bilateral, but is there anything we can put this in perspective with?
Well, there have been a lot of bilateral agreements, as you say, among many of the TPP countries. In fact, the U.S. has bilateral agreements with several existing TPP members. And in addition, there have been big global negotiations like the Uruguay round back in the 1990s. But this is the first so-called mega-regional trade agreement, bringing together a substantial subset of a part of a regional economy. This group represents about 40% of the world economy and a higher percentage of Asia's economy. And so it's the most complex negotiation that's ever been held, I think, certainly at a regional level. And it's one that has these new 21st century elements that are new and different. So it is really unprecedented.
And I want to speak, obviously the economic implications seem to be pretty clear, but obviously we should get into the geopolitical implications in a moment. Before we do that, Scott Miller, I want to bring you in to talk about the negotiations and how these have been long. These have been years in the making, and one of the signs of a good negotiation is when nobody's happy, when everyone goes away thinking that they could have got a little more, a little bit less. Who goes away happy from this?
Sure. Look, I think it's fair to say that we don't know all the details yet, and we won't for some period of time. But when we look into it, I think what we'll discover is, well, perhaps we could have gotten something better. Each party could have gotten something better. This was what was available to the parties at the time, and that's an important place and an important achievement. Before we talk about winners and losers, I think I'd like to reiterate one thing Matt said, which is this is the largest, most significant trade agreement in the last 20 years. You really have to go back to GATT 94, which formed the World Trade Organization, or the NAFTA, which was the first comprehensive free trade agreement, to get anything close to this. In terms of TPP is impressive both in terms of the scale of world trade that it covers, but the depth of the obligations, the depth of the commitments that members have undertaken. So it really is quite a strong achievement. I think what we'll find as we look for the winners of this agreement is I'm expecting to see major improvement in sort of cross-border trade and investment flows. That's the core business of a trade agreement. Certainly, there were many commitments already. The United States, if you look at the 11 parties the United States was negotiating with, all 11 were members of the World Trade Organization, so had the basic obligations of the GATT 94. Six of the parties we negotiated with we already had free trade agreements with. And so for those, we're deepening some existing commitments and incorporating new issues. So for instance, Mexico and Canada are our NAFTA partners. But NAFTA was implemented in 1994, at which time there was no commercial use of the internet. So the TPP has an entire chapter on the digital economy. So these are very large trading partners. We have a very open relationship with Mexico and Canada. But we had a new area of commerce, which was essentially uncovered by disciplines. TPP will provide coverage of that. That's a very important step forward. It also is a platform for further integration. So there are two steps here. One is that the five parties where we had basically what trade people would call MFN relations or the basic WTO commitments, we now have essentially a preferential trade agreement which will provide essentially duty-free, quota-free access for the sale of goods, services. It includes government procurement. And in some cases, these are big, important, growing markets. Malaysia and Vietnam are two I'd point to, which maintained very high tariffs, so basic trade policy stuff, very high tariffs on industrial machinery and equipment and agricultural equipment and things like that, where the United States has a comparative advantage and is an important exporter. So those exporters, think the Caterpillar, John Deere, industrial machining, Cincinnati Milacron, those companies will see a major improvement in their ability to access those markets as the tariffs go to zero. So that's a very important achievement that often didn't get covered in the top lines. At the end of the day, there are always a lot of sensitivities, political sensitivities, sectors which have particular importance in economy. And sometimes there is a conflict because, for instance, in dairy, dairy products often have a very political sensitivity for economies that provide substantial support for dairy farmers, including the United States and Canada. In this case, we had New Zealand, which is probably the world's most competitive dairy exporter, as one of the demanders in the negotiation. The United States has its own sensitivities. Canada has a downright Stalinist, supply management program for managing its dairy sector, which makes exports basically prohibited. So there was a little bit of movement on both sides, and while you won't get complete openness, we didn't get complete openness for U.S. beef into Japan, but there was enough there's enough movement on the parts of all parties. So the New Zealand dairy exporters got a little bit from Canada and the United States. The Australian sugar exporters got a little bit from the United States, where we have our Stalinist sugar program. Okay, so everybody's got something where they had to give a little bit. So on agriculture, you'll see a lot of those trade-offs. But by and large, the big export crops from the United States will find new markets and find much, much better access in those markets. Other areas like intellectual property protection for biopharmaceuticals and biologics was a very important core comparative advantage of both the United States and Japan. And so the length of protection for the data required to qualify those products for market was an area of extreme sensitivity to many U.S. firms. It was one of the last items to close in the negotiation, and so there was a compromise. The U.S. started requesting 12 years. Australia started saying our law is 5 years, and that's it. And we settled what looks like 8 years, although you have to squint to see the 8 years. So, but those kinds of things are not unprecedented in trade negotiations. I think we wound up getting to a place that is pretty okay. And by pretty okay, I mean really solid market access gains for goods, solid gains for cross-border supply of services. Think about Japan being the second largest insurance market in the world, but very difficult for American insurance companies to access. So there'll much be much greater ability for U.S. service providers to access, and not to mention the improvement that Matt mentioned in the architecture of what's going on in the Asia-Pacific commercial space. There are KIPP commitments for product standards, for customs administration, for electronic commerce, for regulatory cooperation and coherence, transparency, anti-corruption measures. These kinds of things, as they are implemented by the 12 parties and perhaps adopted by other parties who want to join the agreement, are going to smooth commerce throughout the commercial space and make improvements for almost every company, large or small.
Scott laid out there a little bit where the U.S. stands to gain from the commercial end. But bigger part of this is what the TPP establishes in rules and norms and what it says about U.S. engagement with Asia. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how it's going to have an effect on how the U.S. is perceived in the region and perhaps the influence it's going to have in the region going forward?
Well, yes. First of all, let me just endorse the explanation Scott gave about the economic benefits, because I think they are very powerful, and I think in the end this agreement stands or falls on whether it delivers economic and commercial benefit, and I think they are substantial both in the market access area and in sort of establishing this set of more predictable rules of the road for commerce in the region. So very powerful economically, and that's the first lens that everybody should be looking through and will look through. Strategically, though, it is also very important, as you suggested. And it's strategically important both because it does embed the United States more deeply in Asia-Pacific regional affairs. The Obama administration has had this policy of rebalancing, used to be called the pivot, towards Asia. And a lot of people in the region welcome that in principle, if it means greater U.S. engagement, because they want the U.S. there. But there is some suspicion that it's been mostly about military posturing and positioning in the region. And so without a strong economic component, it seems hollow or even perhaps somewhat counterproductive. And so the economic leg is very important. And TPP is the core of that economic component of the rebalance. It is a substantial commitment by the United States to the region and as a participant and as a champion of a rules-based order in the area, in this critically dynamic region of the world. And then I'd say even more broadly, there's a strategic economic dimension to this in that the rules of the road in the international economy have served the world well. The rules that have been in place really since the end of World War II, they've served us well, they've served Europe well, they've served China and India and other emerging countries very well. But they are getting a little dusty, a little out of date, not just in the sense that you hear a lot about who gets to write the rules, but actually the substance of the rules themselves. As we alluded to earlier, there's this old-fashioned sort of Ricardian sense of trade being something where you produce something in one place, put it on a ship, and send it somewhere else. And that still happens, but that's not really what trade is about today. It's about supply chains and global connectivity. And in a world where things are happening at all levels of economic integration, you have to have rules that deal with every step along that process. And that's why all of these rules that are being negotiated are very important. And, you know, the United States has traditionally been the champion of those rules. And I think there was some doubt about whether we could deliver on an updated, up, set of rules. And I think we've proven that the U.S. still has the ability to do that. And I think that's a strategic dimension to this story, which sometimes gets blurred in with the notion of the U.S. just being the kind of leader or champion in Asia generally. I think we're also seen as the leader of a global rules-based economic order, and this is another good example of that.
Well, one of the big countries, obviously, that's not part of Trans-Pacific Partnership right now is China. And China, obviously, is a big economic footprint. There's some detractors would say it's a way of kind of freezing out China. Where do you see that going, and where do you see China's kind of rise to be integrated into something like this?
Well, it's true that China is not a participant in this agreement. The agreement's open to China and every other member of the so-called APEC grouping, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Area, of which China is a member. But to be a member, you have to aspire to reach the high standards that were being negotiated in TPP. And so the countries that have joined since the original group of five countries, ultimately 12, the additional members all had to demonstrate, the United States had to demonstrate this when it joined, but Japan and Canada and Mexico, that they really wanted to aspire to these high standard rules. So far, China has not shown that it really wants to make that reach and get into TPP. But I do think the negotiation of TPP has now gotten people's attention in Beijing. And I think they, in fact, in the last year or two, since Japan joined, and this became a group that represented 40% of the world economy, and with one of China's nearest and dearest economic competitors in the group, I think the attitude in Beijing changed, and I think they realized they have to take this thing seriously and think about how China might aspire to join TPP one day. And in the meantime, this TPP negotiation could be used as a lever, as a tool to help drive domestic economic reform in China, which is so critical for their economic transition from an investment export-led model to a more consumption and services-led economic growth model. So TPP was a useful tool, just the way WTO entry in the 1990s was used by former Premier Zhu Rongji to drive reform at home. And so it's had that dynamic effect. And really, that was the point of the TPP strategy, was to try to incentivize countries to aspire to these higher standards and to drive the kind of structural reforms domestically that they needed, but which would also be good for the regional economy. It had the same effect in Japan before Japan joined. And I think that's the way I look at China. Certainly, this is not an effort to exclude China. That wouldn't be possible. China is at the heart of the regional economy in the Asia Pacific. It's the major trading partner of most TPP countries. And it's sort of nonsense to say that TPP was designed to exclude, let alone contain China. Quite the contrary. It was designed to pull China more deeply into the rules-based order at a high standard.
Okay, well, Scott, politics. There's 12 countries involved in this. 12 countries have to now sign off on this agreement. We can talk about the other countries involved, but just in the U.S., how hard is this now? What are the next steps to getting this actually done?
Well, this always becomes the art of the possible. My sense is that each country will have its own ratification challenges. I guess Brunei will be the easiest, but you know, there are many sort of democratic governments who are involved in this. Each will have its own challenge. We'll probably get the first indication of how our partners are doing with this with the upcoming Canadian elections and the degree to which TPP is a factor in it. But for the United States, I think it's important to say we aren't even at the beginning yet when it comes to implementation or congressional approval of an implementing bill. At the moment, what we have are headlines. The Obama administration will now sort of finish the legal scrub on what's probably 600 pages of text and the attached schedules for these 30 chapters that make up the TPP. Once that illegal scrub is done, the president would indicate to the Congress, would communicate that he intends to sign TPP. And that intention to sign triggers a 90-day review period, which includes a congressional review and work by the U.S. International Trade Commission to basically describing the economic effects and the extent to which this meets the negotiating objectives set out in the Trade Promotion Authority document. But also, it will be a public review. You'll be able to download the whole thing if you've got enough paper in your printer to look at it yourself at home. And so it will be at this point, a public document and subject to extensive review. At the end of that 90-day period, the next step would be for the administration to draft an implementing bill. Treaties are not self-executing under U.S. law, that when there's a change to U.S. law, it is the Congress that has to make the change. So the administration would submit a bill which would indicate all the places U.S. law would need to be changed for us to accept the obligations of TPP. And then that bill would be subject to consideration by the committees. It would be agreed between the administration and the Ways and Means and Finance Committee on what the implementing bill's shape ought to be. At that point, there would be a bill introduced which would be protected by the provisions in TPA from amendment, and it would have a certain – it need to be considered with a time certain. My own view is all this will take place. Certainly the 90-day period can't be cut short. But my assumption is about springtime, the Congress will begin in 2016, the Congress will be in a position to work on this. Now, let's put that in the context of U.S. presidential politics. At the moment, there isn't much action, but there is a lot of Sturm und Drang, okay, and that'll continue. That's fine. By mid-March, more than half of U.S. primary voters will have cast a ballot, and it's highly likely that sort of by St. Patrick's Day or so, that it the American people will have a very clear idea about who the Republican and Democratic nominees will be. At that point, also a number of members of Congress will have been past their primary elections and be either on the ballot or however that works out for them. At that point, I think we'll be in a better political position as a country to contemplate something like TPP. My own recollection is to compare this period of time to 1999-2000. The big action in 1999 was China's accession to the WTO. It was quite politically controversial. It wound up being a proximate cause for a chaotic World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, Washington, the ministerial meeting. By spring, the Congress passed essentially provided permanent normal trade relations to China, extended it. The House passed it with a fairly strong bipartisan majority. I think about 70 Democrats voted in favor of that bill. The Senate passed the bill identically, and we had a signing ceremony in the springtime. That China PNTR never was a factor in the Bush v. Gore election of 2000. So my own sort of experience is we're probably on that kind of timetable, and we'll see how the politics play out.
Looking forward into that springtime era when primaries are happening, 2016 is in full flow in terms of the presidential election. The Democratic side of the ticket, Hillary Clinton yesterday saying that she was not in favor of TPP, which brings all the Democrats not in favor of TPP. On the Republican side, kind of a lukewarm reception to TPP, mostly for it, but in kind of a qualified way. Two questions. One is, does that affect how TPP is going to be implemented? Does it have any effects on how it will actually go forward? And the second question is kind of broader, but what does this say about how Americans view trade? And is that something that is always going to be the case in American society, just how people think about it? Or is it something that those who actually on the side of wanting a more open and free trade and global trade environment need to do a better job of?
Well, I think it's not helpful that the Democratic presidential candidates have all come out with more or less opposition to TPP, although Hillary Clinton's language was a little bit hedged in the sense that she said, based on what I've seen so far, it doesn't seem to live up to what I was expecting. So she might have a little wiggle room if she becomes the nominee. And I think, as Scott was suggesting, if she becomes the nominee, she's going to have an incentive to move back to the center, and you know, in the center there are more people who support trade. So I think she might try to find a way to wiggle back. On the Republican side, the leading contender right now, Donald Trump, has been very negative. Some of the other candidates, I think, have been a little more hedged. I would expect in the end, though, and this is not helpful, you know, to the overall view and discussion, debate about TPP, but it is early days, and I think you'll find once you have that single candidate on each side and you have serious congressional consideration of this that, you know, there are going to be other things coming into play. And I think on the Democratic side, there's going to be a strong incentive to try to get this done and, you know, for Obama to have this seal his legacy as a leading both legacy both in Asia as a significant part of his rebalancing strategy and his economic legacy since he, remember, started as president during an economic crisis. And so I think, you know, he's going to have a strong incentive to try to get this done and try to push people over the line and don't need that many Democrats, unfortunately, to get it over the line, provided the Republican Party, which is strongly pro-trade and should be pro-TPP in general, you know, ends up delivering the votes that are needed. So I think in the end, my own personal guess is that this will ultimately pass. It may be very noisy. It may be very difficult. The timing's a little uncertain, but I think in the end it goes through. And I think in a way, to your deeper question, I think it reflects the fact that Americans are not against trade. I think they understand. In fact, polling shows that, if anything, the support for trade is increasing. I think people understand that we're in a global economy and we have to compete. I do think, you know, there are obviously some very specific costs and transitional costs from trade that can be very painful and have political ramifications. But on the whole, Americans, I think, are pretty supportive of trade. And I think in the end, that will be reflected in the people's body in some form or another. And I think it'll end up meaning a pass TPP eventually.
Yeah, I think that the good news is that America is much more deeply engaged with the world than we were 20 or 40 years ago. And the American people are aware of that. Their lives depend on it. Their careers and work depends on it. And the people seem to get it. Now, Congress is often the last to know. And politicians are not usually have to be brought along by their constituents on things like this. So I have a sense of optimism about this. I think first the American people are prepared to compete and win in the world and do a good job of it every day, and that ultimately TPP will be viewed as something that is a help, not a hindrance, to engaging with the world.
And that was Matt Goodman and Scott Miller. Next, we turn to South Korean President Park Geun-hye's upcoming visit to Washington October 15th to meet with President Obama at the White House. In advance of Madam Park's visit to Washington, where she'll also deliver a speech at CSIS, my colleague, CSIS Asia Policy blog editor Jeff Bean, caught up with CSIS Korea Chair Victor Cha to discuss the state of U.S.-South Korea relations and what's on the agenda for the summit.
Hi, my name is Jeff Bean. I'm the editor of the CSIS Asia Policy blog, Kajet Asia. My guest today is Dr. Victor Cha, the CSIS Korea Chair. Victor, I want to ask, can you give us a snapshot of South Korea-U.S. relations as we get set for President Park's visit?
Well, I think the relationship is seen by many today as being in the best shape that it's ever been. The relationship between President Park and President Obama is very good at a personal level. There's, I think, a deep reservoir of trust in the relationship, and I think they generally like each other as people. That's very important. You can never overestimate how important that is for overall relations between countries. But beyond the personal relationship, the alliance is quite strong, and the alliance has grown in its scope, not just in terms of military issues on the peninsula, but on the economic side, the signing of a free trade agreement between the two countries in terms of foreign direct investment. And also on a global scale, the U.S. and Koreans are working together in different parts of the world on issues ranging from development assistance to global health. So the overall scope and depth of the alliance is really at unprecedented levels. And so for that reason, the timing of this visit coming up is very good.
You mentioned the strong relationship between President Park and President Obama. Obviously, President Obama is ending or coming to the end of his second term, and President Park is time term limited in terms of her five-year term. What do you think Seoul and Washington aim to achieve through this series of meetings?
Well, I think three things. The first thing is displaying to the world that there is no space between them on North Korea. Strong message on deterrence with regard to North Korea, strong message about the overall alliance relationship as they work towards eventual transition of operational command from the U.S. To the South Koreans. I think the second message will be economics. President Park is trying to implement some structural reform in Korea, which they see as an impediment to more accelerated growth. Korea's growth now is down below 3% or hovering around 3% when the aspirations are for it to be around 4% or higher. And so I'm sure that they'll have a discussion about economics, and President Obama will want to support President Park's effort at structural reform. The latest iteration of this has been a large agreement on labor reform that she needs to get through her parliament. Also on the economic side, the fact that TPP now looks like it's about done will, I think, cast a bigger shadow over the meeting next week, because South Korea is not a charter member of TPP, but they certainly want to be a part of TPP. And much of the framework of TPP was borrowed from the framework for CORUS, the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, the concept of a high standards, high quality free trade agreement, which does not just reduce tariffs, but it eliminates non-tariff barriers and penetrates into participant countries, affecting things like environmental standards, labor standards, intellectual property, all these sorts of things. So very deep reaching agreements. So Korea wants to be a part of this, and I'm sure that they'll have a discussion. They've already had discussion about Korea being one of the first countries to sign on to TPP after it is completed. And then the third issue, I would think, is what some experts refer to as the new horizons or the new frontiers in the U.S.-Korea alliance. And as I mentioned earlier, that is things like the U.S.-Korea alliance off the peninsula on a global scale. So there's been a lot of cooperation between the U.S. and South Korea on cybersecurity after the Dark Seoul incidents in South Korea and then the hacking of Sony. There's been a lot of work between the two countries on this, and I expect that the two leaders will talk about this. as I mentioned, global health is another area where the South Koreans have been especially energized after the MERS crisis over the summer. South Korea is going to chair the global health security agenda in 2017, and they've contributed something like 100 or 200 million to the global health initiative, trying to find a vaccine for the corona family of viruses, which include MERS as well as SARS. Another area is, in terms of new horizons, are literally new frontiers in terms of outer space. I think the two countries are looking to cooperate in terms of things like space launch and technology. And then development is another area where few people know that Korea has the second largest Peace Corps in the world, next to the United States. And they're all over the world, particularly in Southeast Asia. One example of this is that the United States just recently opened relations with Burma or Myanmar. And we'll be sending the Peace Corps there, but they've never operated there before. On the other hand, the South Koreans, through their Peace Corps program, have been in Burma now for half a decade. So there are opportunities where the two countries can cooperate and in many ways flip the traditional relationship, which has always been the United States teaching South Korea how to do things. And in this case, it would be the South Koreans helping the United States acclimate to a new environment that they're familiar with. So, you know, North Korea, I think trade and econ issues, and then these new frontiers or new horizons will probably be the three big messages coming out of the visit.
Now, on the subject of North Korea, the IAEA has said that there are signs of increased activity at the Yongbyon nuclear facility within North Korea. And, of course, you have the 70th anniversary celebration for the ruling Workers' Party coming up on October 10th. Are there any signs for you of a North Korean provocation in the offing?
Well, we're always guessing when it comes to North Korea in terms of what they're going to do. They seem to telegraph early on through statements that they might do something on October 10th, as you said, the 70th anniversary of the party. At least commercial satellite photography and media reports, public media reports of commercial satellite photography suggest that there aren't preparations right now for a missile test. But with North Korea, you just never know what to expect. There'll certainly be a parade where they will display all of their new weaponry, whether it's actually operational or whether they're mock-ups, we don't know. But they'll certainly display, I think, a lot of their missiles and their artillery and things of this nature. And that in itself will be a little bit provocative. And maybe they don't do something on October 10th, but they may do something near that date. It could be after President Park comes to Washington. It could be before. The main thing is that whatever they do, it's very important that the U.S. and Korea are very firm in terms of their response, are resolute in terms of taking the issue to the U.N. Security Council. And both of them work very hard to get China on board in terms of how to deal with or respond to the next North Korean provocation. President Obama just met with Xi Jinping. President Park just met with Xi Jinping. President Park is coming here to meet with President Obama. So there's a lot of opportunities for the three leaders to try to open a genuine discussion about the future of the Korean Peninsula. That's something that's been lacking for quite some time, and yet these parties are the most important parties should something happen in North Korea.
That was Victor Cha. Now on to our one to watch, Taiwan's elections. Taiwan's ruling KMT party took the extraordinary step of calling an unscheduled party congress this week in an effort to review strategy ahead of national elections in January. The campaign of the KMT's presidential nominee, Ms. Hong Xiuqiu, has struggled to gain traction against that of the Democratic Progressive Party candidate, Ms. Tsai Ing-wen. Current Taiwan President Ma of the KMT is entering his final months in office and has suffered low public approval ratings during most of his second term. KMT party leadership attempted to generate interest from its supporters and spice up the party's ticket during this election cycle by nominating Ms. Hong, who has the nickname in Chinese of Little Hot Pepper, for her blunt assessment of problems and straight-talking style. Yet she has struggled to appeal to the broader electorate so far, and now faces criticism from within her party. Ms. Tsai Ing-wen and her colleagues in the DPP have built up a considerable lead in pre-election polling over concerns about Ms. Hong's pro-China views. Hong had previously supported a pro-unification stance with regard to the mainland, but has attempted to moderate that position during the campaign. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.